This lecture, Education and the Racist Road to Barbarism, which is presented here without benefit of a live audience, was delivered at various universities in the early 1990s, among them the University of Wisconsin, the University of Michigan, and the University of Minnesota. Major changes are taking place in the philosophy of American education. Changes which are potentially capable of having an enormous impact on all aspects of American life. The changes are inspired by what the New York Times refers to as the Eurocentrism critique. According to the Times, Eurocentrism is a pejorative term supposed to describe, quote, a provincial outlook that focuses overwhelmingly on European and Western culture while giving short shrift to Asia, Africa, and Latin America, unquote. A typical manifestation of Eurocentrism, according to its critics, is the statement that Columbus discovered America. This statement, which most children in America may have learned as their very first fact of history, is now regarded as controversial. Indeed, it is held to be positively offensive because it implies that, quote, there had been no other people on the continent, unquote, before Columbus arrived. Traditional American education in general is denounced for seeing the world, quote, only through a Western lens, unquote. Only through that lens, it is held, can, for example, African art be regarded as primitive. In an effort to eliminate such alleged Western and European bias, in quotes, schools are altering the way in which history, literature, and the arts are being taught. Recent changes at Stanford University, where a course on Western civilization was replaced by one in which non-Western ideas had to be included, are only one case in point. The revisions in the history curriculum in California's public school system to emphasize Indian and African cultures are another. Curricula and textbooks are being widely rewritten, and as evidence of the depth of the changes, the Times reports that efforts are underway, quote, to reconstruct the history of African tribes, going beyond relying on accounts of Western travelers to examining indigenous sources, often oral, and adapting anthropological approaches, unquote. The implications of these changes are enormous. The acceptance of the Eurocentrism critique and its denial of such propositions as Columbus discovered America speaks volumes about the state of the educational establishment in the United States and the intellectual establishment in general. In order to understand the implications, it is first necessary to remind oneself what Western civilization is. From a historical perspective, Western civilization embraces two main periods, the era of Greco-Roman civilization and the era of modern Western civilization, which latter encompasses the rediscovery of Greco-Roman civilization in the late Middle Ages and the periods of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Industrial Revolution. Modern Western civilization continues down to the present moment, of course, as the dominant force in the culture of the countries of Western Europe and the United States, and the other countries settled by the descendants of West Europeans. It is an increasingly powerful force in the rapidly progressing countries of the Far East, such as Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, whose economies rest on Western foundations in every essential respect. From the perspective of intellectual and cultural content, Western civilization represents an understanding and acceptance of the following: the laws of logic, the concept of causality, and consequently of a universe ruled by natural laws intelligible to men. On these foundations, the whole known corpus of the laws of mathematics and science. The individual's self-responsibility based on his free will to choose between good and evil. The value of man above all other species on the basis of his unique possession of the power of reason. the value and competence of the individual human being and his corollary possession of individual rights, among them the right to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness, the need for limited government and for the individual's freedom from the state. On this entire preceding foundation, the validity of capitalism, with its unprecedented and continuing progress, capital accumulation, and rising living standards. In addition, the importance of visual arts and literature depicting man as capable of facing the world with confidence in his power to succeed, and music featuring harmony and melody. Once one recalls what Western civilization is, the most vital thing to realize about it is that it is open to everyone. Indeed, important elements of Western civilization did not even originate in the West. The civilization of the Greeks and Romans incorporated significant aspects of science that were handed down from Egypt and Babylon. Modern Western civilization includes contributions from people living in the Middle East and China during the Dark Ages, when Western Europe had reverted to virtual barbarism. Indeed, during the Dark Ages, Western civilization resided much more in the Middle East than in Western Europe. It is conceivable that if present trends continue, in another century it might reside more in the Far East than in the West. The truth is that just as one does not have to be from France to like French fried potatoes, or from New York to like a New York steak, one does not have to be born in Western Europe or be of West European descent to admire Western civilization, or indeed even to help build it. Western civilization is not a product of geography. It is a body of knowledge and values. Any individual, any society, is potentially capable of adopting it and thereby becoming westernized. The rapidly progressing economies of the Far East are all Western insofar as they rest on a foundation of logic, mathematics, science, technology, and capitalism, exactly the same logic, mathematics, science, technology, and capitalism that are essential features of Western civilization. For the case of a westernized individual, I must think of myself. I am not of West European descent. All four of my grandparents came to the United States from Russia about a century ago. Modern Western civilization did not originate in Russia and hardly touched it. The only connection my more remote ancestors had with the civilization of Greece and Rome was probably to help in looting and plundering it. Nevertheless, I am thoroughly a Westerner. I am a Westerner because of the ideas and values I hold. I have thoroughly internalized all of the leading features of Western civilization. They are now my ideas and my values. Holding these ideas and values as I do, I would be a Westerner wherever I lived and whenever I was born. I identify with Greece and Rome and not with my ancestors of that time because I share the values of Greece and Rome, not those of my ancestors. To put it bluntly, my ancestors were savages, certainly up to about 1,000 years ago, and for all practical purposes, probably as recently as 4 or 5 generations ago. I know nothing for certain about my great-grandparents, but if they lived in rural Russia in the middle of the 19th century, they were almost certainly totally illiterate, highly superstitious, and primitive in every way. On winter nights, they probably slept with farm animals in their hut to keep warm, as was once a common practice in Northern Europe, and were personally filthy and lice-infested. I see absolutely nothing of value in their, quote, way of life, unquote, if it can be called a way of life, and I am immeasurably grateful that my grandparents had the good sense to abandon it and come to America, so that I could have the opportunity of becoming a Westerner. And better still, an American Westerner, because in most respects, since colonial times, the United States has always been, intellectually and culturally, the most Western of the Western countries. Thus, I am a descendant of savages who dwelt in Eastern Europe, and before that probably the steppes of Asia, who has been westernized and now sees the world entirely through a Western lens, to use the term of the critics of Eurocentrism. Of course, it is not really a lens through which I see the world. It is much more fundamental than that. I have developed a Western mind, a mind enlightened and thoroughly transformed by the enormous body of knowledge that represents the substance of Western civilization. And I now see the world entirely on the basis of that knowledge. For example, I see the world on the foundation of the laws of logic, mathematics, and science that I have learned. And whenever something new or unexpected happens which I do not understand, I know that it must nevertheless have a cause, which I am capable of discovering. In these respects, I differ profoundly from my savage ancestors, who lacked the knowledge to see the world from a scientific perspective, and who probably felt helpless and terrified in the face of anything new or unknown, because, lacking the principle of causality and knowledge of the laws of logic, they simply had no basis for expecting to be able to come to an understanding of it. It is on the basis of the same foundation of knowledge that I regard the discoverer of the Western Hemisphere to be Columbus rather than the very first human beings to arrive on the North American continent, probably across a land bridge from Asia, and rather than the Norwegian Leif Erikson. I consider Columbus to be the discoverer, not because of any such absurd reason as a preference for Europeans over Asiatics. Leif Erikson was as much a European as Columbus, but because it was Columbus who opened the Western Hemisphere to the civilization I have made my own. Columbus was the man who made it possible to bring to these shores my ideas and values. It is not from the perspective of the residents of my ancestors, who were certainly not Italian or Spanish or even West European, that I regard Columbus as the discoverer of America, but from the perspective of the residents of my ideas and values. Just as at an earlier time they resided in Greece and Rome rather than in the Russia of my ancestors, so in the 15th and 16th centuries the home of my ideas and values was in Western Europe. I hold Columbus to have been the discoverer of America from that perspective. This is the perspective that any educated person would hold. There is no need for me to dwell any further on my own savage ancestors. The plain truth is that everyone's ancestors were savages. Indeed, at least 99.5% of everyone's ancestors were savages, even in the case of descendants of the founders of the world's oldest civilizations. For mankind has existed on Earth for a million years, and yet the very oldest of civilizations, as judged by the criterion of having possessed a written language, did not appear until less than 5,000 years ago. The ancestors of those who today live in Britain or France or most of Spain were savages as recently as the time of Julius Caesar, slightly more than 2,000 years ago. Thus, on the scale of mankind's total presence on Earth, today's Englishmen, Frenchmen, and Spaniards earn an ancestral savagery rating of 99.8%. The ancestors of present-day Germans and Scandinavians were savages even more recently, and thus today's Germans and Scandinavians probably deserved an ancestral savagery rating of at least 99.9%. It is important to stress these facts to be aware how little significance is to be attached to the members of any race or linguistic group achieving civilization sooner rather than later. Between the descendants of the world's oldest civilizations and those who might first aspire to civilization at the present moment, there is a difference of at most 0.5% on the time scale of man's existence on Earth. These observations should confirm the fact that there is no reason for believing that civilization is in any way a property of any particular race or ethnic group. It is strictly an intellectual matter, ultimately a matter of the presence or absence of certain fundamental ideas underlying the acquisition of further knowledge. Those peoples who possess a written language may be called civilized, inasmuch as writing is an indispensable means for the transmission of substantial knowledge, and thus for the accumulation of knowledge from generation to generation. Those who possess not only a written language, but also knowledge of the laws of logic and the principle of causality, are in a position to accumulate and transmit incomparably more knowledge than people who possess merely the art of writing alone. On this basis, Greco-Roman civilization is on a higher plane than any that had preceded it. Finally, a civilization which possesses still further fundamental applications of human reason, such as the far more extensive development and elaboration of the principles of mathematics and science, the existence of the freedoms of speech and press, and the development of a division of labor economy, is a higher civilization than even that of Greece and Rome. The freedoms of speech and press are an essential guarantee of the individual's right to disseminate knowledge without being stopped by the fears or superstitions of any group backed by the coercive power of the state. A division of labor economy makes possible a corresponding multiplication of the amount of knowledge applied to production and to meeting the needs of human life. For such knowledge exists essentially in proportion to the number of separate occupations being practiced, each with its own specialized body of knowledge. Equally or even more important, a division of labor economy means that geniuses can devote their talents full-time to such fields as science, education, invention, and business, with a corresponding progressive increase in knowledge and improvement in human life. Such a civilization, of course, is our very own modern Western civilization, incomparably the greatest civilization which has ever existed, and which, until fairly recently, had repeatedly been carried to its very highest points in most respects right here in the United States. The fact that civilization is an intellectual matter is not known to the critics of Eurocentrism. In their view, Western civilization is a matter not even so much of geography as it is of racial membership. It is, as they see it, the civilization of the white man. In reporting the changes in California's world history curriculum, the Times notes significantly that Hispanic, Asian, and Black students now make up a majority of the 4.4 million pupils in the state. It quotes the co-author of the new curriculum as saying, many educators believe that, quote, people who have non-European backgrounds don't feel their antecedents lie in Europe, unquote. Another critic of Eurocentrism, who is described as, quote, heading an overhauling of the public school curriculum of Camden, New Jersey, to stress a more Afrocentric and Latino-centric approach, unquote, is quoted as saying, quote, we are not living in a Western country. The American project is not yet completed. It is only in the eyes of the Eurocentrists who see it as a Western project, which means to hell with the rest of the people who have yet to create the project. Unquote. In these statements, Western civilization is clearly identified with people of a certain type, namely the West Europeans and their descendants, who are white. Students descended from Asiatics or Africans, it is assumed, can feel at home only to the extent that the curriculum is revised to give greater stress to the, quote, ancient civilizations of China, India, and Africa, the growth of Islam, and the development of sub-Saharan Africa, unquote. The critics of Eurocentrism proclaim themselves to be opponents of racism. In fact, they adopt exactly the same false premise they claim to oppose, namely, that civilization, or the lack of it, is racially determined. In earlier centuries, men of European descent observed the marked cultural inferiority of the native populations of Africa, Asia, and the Western Hemisphere, and assumed that the explanation lay in a racial inferiority of these peoples. In passing this judgment, they forgot the cultural state of their own ancestors, which was as much below their own as that of any of these peoples. They also overlooked the very primitive cultural state of many Europeans then living in the eastern part of the continent, and of Caucasians living in the Middle East. Even more important, they failed to see how, in accepting racism, they contradicted the essential Western doctrine of individual free will and individual responsibility for choices made. For in condemning people as inferior on the basis of their race, they were holding individuals morally responsible for circumstances over which they had absolutely no control. At the same time, they credited themselves with accomplishments which were hardly their creations, but those of a comparative handful of other individuals, most of whom had happened to be of the same race, and who, ironically enough, had had to struggle against the indifference, or even outright hostility, of the great majority of the members of their own race in order to create civilization. Today, the critics of Eurocentrism rightly refuse to accept any form of condemnation for their racial membership. They claim to hold that race is irrelevant to morality and that therefore people of every race are as good as people of every other race. But then they assume that if people of all races are equally good, all civilizations and cultures must be equally good. They derive civilization and culture from race, just as the European racists did. And this is why they too must be called racists. They differ from the European racists only in that, while the latter started with the judgment of an inferior civilization or culture and proceeded backwards to the conclusion of an inferior race, the former begin with the judgment of an equally good race and proceed forward to the conclusion of an equally good civilization or culture. The error of both sets of racists is the same, the belief that civilization and culture are racially determined. The racism of these newer racists, which is now being imposed on the educational system, implies a radical devaluation of civilization, knowledge, and education. The new racists do not want students to study non-Western civilizations and the conditions of primitive peoples from the perspective of seeing how they lag behind Western civilization and what they might do to catch up. Study from that perspective would be denounced as seeing the world through a, quote, Western lens, unquote. It would be considered offensive to people of non-West European origin. No. What they want is to conduct the study of the various civilizations, and even the state of outright savagery itself, in a way that makes all appear equal. It is assumed, for example, that black students can feel themselves to be the equal of white students only if their sub-Saharan ancestors are presented as, in a fundamental sense, culturally equivalent to modern West Europeans or Americans. Now, such a program means the explicit obliteration of distinctions among levels of civilization and between civilization and savagery. It presents ignorance as the equivalent of knowledge, and superstition as the equivalent of science. Everything, logic, philosophy, science, law, technology, is to be ignored, and a culture limited to the level of making dugout canoes is to be regarded as the equivalent of one capable of launching spaceships. And all this is for the alleged sake of not offending anyone who supposedly must feel inferior if such a monumental fraud is not committed. I believe, contrary to the expectations of the new racists, that their program must be grossly offensive to the very students it is designed to reassure. I know that I would be personally outraged if I were told that my intellectual capacities and personal values had been irrevocably defined for me by my ancestors, and that now I was to think of myself in terms of the folkways of Russian peasants. I believe that if my ancestors had been Africans, and, for example, I wanted to be an artist, I could readily accept the fact that art produced on the basis of a knowledge of perspective, geometry, human anatomy, and the refraction of light was a higher form of art than that produced in ignorance of such considerations. I would readily accept the fact that the latter type of art was indeed primitive. I would not feel that I was unable to learn these disciplines merely because my ancestors or other contemporary members of my race had not. I would feel the utmost contempt for the deliberate, chosen primitiveness of those artists, in quotes, almost all white, who had reverted to the level of art of my and their primitive ancestors. Race is not the determinant of culture. Not only is Western civilization open to the members of every race, but its present possessors are also potentially capable of losing it, just as the people of the Western Roman Empire once lost the high degree of civilization they had achieved. What makes the acceptance of the Eurocentrism critique so significant is that it so clearly reveals just how tenuous our ability to maintain Western civilization has become. The preservation of Western civilization is not automatic. In the span of less than a century, virtually the entire population at the end consists of people who are not alive at the beginning. Western civilization, or any civilization, can continue only insofar as its intellectual substance lives on in the minds of new generations. And it can do so only if it is imparted to young minds through education. Education is the formal process of transmitting the intellectual substance of civilization from one generation to the next, and thereby developing the uncultivated minds of children into those of civilized adults. Western civilization is imparted to young minds in the teaching of Euclidean geometry and Newtonian physics, no less than in the teaching of the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle, or the plays of Shakespeare. It is imparted in the teaching of every significant subject, from arithmetic to nuclear physics, from reading and writing to the causes of the rise and fall of civilizations. Wherever the intellectual substance of Western civilization is known, its transmission to the minds of students is virtually coextensive with the process of education. For the intellectual substance of Western civilization is nothing other than the fundamentals underlying the highest levels of knowledge attained anywhere on earth, and if the purpose of education is to impart knowledge, then its purpose is to impart Western civilization. Thus, to the extent that the process of education is undermined, the whole of civilization must also be undermined, starting a generation later. These results will appear more and more striking as time goes on, and as more and more defectively educated people take the place of those whose education was better. The worsening effects will likely be further intensified as those whose own education was defective become educators themselves, and thus cause succeeding generations to be still more poorly educated. Education in the United States has been in obvious decline for decades, and in some ways that are critical but not obvious, perhaps for generations. The decline has become visible in such phenomena as the rewriting of college textbooks to conform with the more limited vocabularies of present-day students. It is visible in the functional illiteracy of large numbers of high school and even college graduates, in their inability to articulate their thoughts or to solve relatively simple problems in mathematics or even plain arithmetic, and in their profound lack of elementary knowledge of science and history. I believe that the decline in education is probably responsible for the widespread use of drugs. To live in the midst of a civilized society with a level of knowledge closer perhaps to that of a primitive man than to that which a civilized adult requires, which regrettably is the intellectual state of many of today's students and graduates, must be a terrifying experience, urgently calling for some kind of relief, and drugs may appear to many to be the solution. I believe that this also accounts for the relatively recent phenomenon of the public's fear of science and technology. Science and technology are increasingly viewed in reality as they used to be humorously depicted in Boris Karloff or Bela Lugosi movies, namely as frightening experiments going on in Frankenstein's castle, with large numbers of present-day American citizens casting themselves in a real-life role of terrified and angry Transylvanian peasants seeking to smash whatever emerges from such laboratories. This attitude is the result not only of lack of education in science, but more fundamentally, loss of the ability to think critically, an ability which contemporary education provides little or no basis for developing. Because of their growing lack of knowledge and ability to think, people are becoming increasingly credulous and quick to panic. Thus, the critique of Eurocentrism and any changes in curricula that may result from it can hardly be blamed for inaugurating the decline in American education. On the contrary, it is a product of that decline. The fact that it is being accepted almost without opposition is evidence of how far the decline has already gone. The equivalence of all cultures, the equivalence of civilization and savagery, is the avowed claim of the doctrine of cultural relativism, which has long been accepted by practically the whole of the educational establishment. It, in turn, is a consequence of the still older, more fundamental doctrine that there is no objective foundation for values, that all value judgments are arbitrary and subjective. The new racists are now merely cashing in on this view and attempting to apply it on the largest possible scale, in the process substantially altering the manner in which subjects are taught. Today's educational establishment has fewer compunctions about putting absurd ideas into practice, probably because of the deteriorated state of its own education. Many of its members were educated in the 1960s in the environment of the so-called student rebellion. The fact that the educational and intellectual establishments are fully in agreement with the fundamental premises of the new racists helps to explain why, even when their members are opposed to the Eurocentrism critique, they have nothing of substance to say against it. As reported by the Times, the objections raised amounted to nothing more than complaints about the difficulty of finding non-European writers, philosophers, and artists to replace the European ones dropped from the curricula, and grumblings about the lack of Americans able to teach authoritatively about non-European cultures. In capitulating to the Eurocentrism critique, the educational establishment has reached the point of reducing education to a level below that of ordinary ward politics. Education is now to be a matter of pressure group politics based on the totally false assumptions of racism. If there is a majority of black, Hispanic, or Asian students in an area, then that fact is to be allowed to determine the substance of education, in the belief that these groups somehow secrete, as it were, a different kind of civilization and culture than do whites, and require a correspondingly different kind of education. Colleges in the United States have demonstrated such utter philosophical corruption in connection with this subject that if there were a group of students willing to assert with pride their descent from the Vandals or Huns and to demand courses on the cultural contributions of their ancestors, the schools would provide such courses. All that the students would have to do to get their way is to threaten to burn down the campus. But what best sums up everything involved is this. From now on, in the state of California, a student is to go through 12 years of public school, and the explicit goal of his education is that at the end of it, if he envisions Columbus being greeted by spear-carrying savages, and he happens not to be white, he should identify with the savages. And if he does happen to be white, and therefore is allowed to identify with Columbus, he should not have any idea of why it is in any way better to identify with Columbus than with the savages. This is no longer an educational system. Its character has been completely transformed, and it now clearly reveals itself to be what for many decades it has been in the process of becoming, namely an agency working for the barbarization of youth. The value of education is derived from the value of civilization, whose guardian and perpetuator education is supposed to be. An educational system dedicated to the barbarization of youth is a self-contradictory monstrosity that must be cast out and replaced with a true educational system. But this can be done only by those who genuinely understand and are able to defend the objective value of Western civilization.
On November 7, 1990, Dr. Reisman was a guest of David Brudnoy on his show on WBZ Radio in Boston.
WBZ has allowed the Jefferson School to include that program on this cassette. It follows now.
10:07, and time once again for the David Brudnoy program.
Entertainment. Our guests will find me very bizarre. I shouldn't be doing this, should I? This is because we have not yet. We've got to get Brother Bernstein to sit down and tape new extolling intros here. We have a new phone number, 254-1030. You can let the sound down, right? I really like the Hallelujah Chorus, which, Tony, they greeted me with my first night back in September 24th, and I told David Bernstein I wanted Mozart. Next year is the 200th anniversary of the death of Mozart. Mozart, it can reasonably be argued, though a case can be made for Bach as well, but for none others, Mozart, it can reasonably be argued, is the greatest musician the world has ever known. He was Austrian. He lived in Vienna and Salzburg. He lived briefly in London. He spent time in many other cities. He died at age 37. He wrote the greatest music ever written, I believe, and he is played in Red China and Japan and Zaire and Yugoslavia by people who have nothing in common with Austrians, and many who have nothing in common ethnically or racially with Europeans, and people perhaps who can't speak a word of a European language. They have absorbed Mozart's music, fine musicians in every country in the world, because Mozart is great. He is the greatest. No musician in Latin America, Africa, Asia, or Eastern Europe is the equal of Mozart. No musician in America, North or South, or Australia is the equal of Mozart. How can it be that people all over the world can absorb Mozart and not be Austrian? It's an interesting question, and there are some people who ask it and actually puzzle over it and say, how can that be? Maybe, gee, if you're not Austrian, maybe you shouldn't play Mozart. You should only play the music of your ancestors, even if the music they have made is fourth or fifth rate. Let's not put into Dr. George Riesman's mouth any views that are not his own, and he may disagree on Mozart or on the example I've given by way of introduction, but I doubt that he will disagree strongly. Dr. Riesman is an economics professor in Los Angeles at Pepperdine University. He's written a book, The Government Against the Economy, and many other articles over the years. In the current issue of the Freeman magazine, his piece, Education and the Racist Road to Barbarism, attempts to differentiate that which is, should we say, adherence to the finest of culture from that which is merely reiteration of one's ancestry. Sometimes you're lucky and the two coincide. Sometimes you're not and the two don't. Can you have it both ways? Can you be whatever you are ethnically, racially, linguistically, and be proud of it, as all one would hope should be able to be proud of their ancestry and themselves, and at the same time acknowledge that there are useful and glorious things in other cultures, particularly in this modern world, in the culture of the West? The answer to that must be yes, unless we wish to go down a racist road to barbarism. Dr. Riesman, thank you for joining us tonight on WBZ. It's a pleasure to meet you finally.
Well, I'm delighted to be on your program, Dave.
It's a superb piece, and I wonder if you could lay out for us, perhaps at some length, as Charles Sykes laid out for us a couple of weeks ago in regard to his new book, some of the critiques of the notion that it is in fact absorbable by all people. That is to say that fine culture, the things that make the world go progressively and with enormous benefits to all, that may not in fact be your ancestry. As you point out, your ancestors were illiterate, filthy, unkempt peasants, maybe in Russia, and so be it, but you're not. Why aren't you?
Well, I don't think there is any connection between what an individual is and his ancestry, racial or ethnic. I don't think it's of any significance to an individual today who his ancestors were. Everyone's ancestors, if we look back far enough, were savages, the overwhelming majority of them.
Yes.
You know, mankind has been on Earth for about 1,000,000 years, and the oldest civilization is only 5,000 years old. So the descendants of the oldest civilization, 99.5% of their ancestors were savages. And there's nothing to be proud of in the great majority of one's ancestors for anybody.
I was playing today some Mozart being sung by Jesse Norman, and than whom there are fewer voices in the world, I think. And I thought, I wonder if when Jesse Norman was growing up, anybody would have been so silly to have said to her, well, Jesse, you shouldn't learn to sing Mozart, because if you do, after all, Mozart is not your ancestry. I don't know, but that when people start talking this way, as many do nowadays, especially on some of the campuses, among them the forerunner campuses, the finer universities, many within the sound of our voice right now,
yeah,
that they don't hang their head in shame to try to tell people that it is inappropriate to revel in and absorb the glories of the world wherever they come from, irrespective of the color of one's skin or other irrelevant criteria of what one absorbs in culture. And yet we know that this is a new and rather frightening trend hither and yon, this attack on Eurocentrism as if somehow this is good for anybody. I wonder if you could help us understand why people do this with a straight face. Is it jealousy? Is it stupidity? Is it evil? Is the ozone layer to blame? I mean, what leads people to doing something as counterproductive as that to themselves and their fellow whatevers?
Well, I think that ultimately what's involved in this return to attaching importance to ancestry is a collapse of rational alternatives. People are turning to valuing their ancestors because they're at sea. They have nothing to hang on to. A graduate or a student at a contemporary university is no longer given any solid intellectual foundations. He's not taught anything that he can feel confident in and value, so he clutches for straws, one of which can be his racial membership or his ancestral background. You know, if you think of the way the United States was a few generations ago with all of the immigrants,
mm-hmm,
those people did not attach significance to their ancestral background. They were willing to throw it all over to come to a brand new country that had freedom and offered them opportunities and offered them the possibility of prosperity, and which was rational, and that's what they valued. So they chose to become Americans and weren't interested in continuing to be Bavarians or Russians or Italians or whatever.
When Yo-Yo Ma plays in Boston, sometimes you get the interesting combination of Chang Cho-Lin and Emmanuel Axe and Yo-Yo Ma playing as they have on various records over the years, and sometimes together. And I wonder, here are three people from backgrounds who, playing what they play, should, by the current a fashionable notion of disparaging the European culture, shouldn't be doing it together, because they don't come from where the music they play originated. And it's one of the things, a lady friend of mine says, only in America would one go to a concert of, say, Mozart, Yo-Yo Ma, Zhang Cholin, and Emmanuel Axe playing Mozart. It isn't, in fact, only in America, but it is one of our glories, is that here and in some other places, we bring people of all backgrounds together to do what they do best, irrespective of the color of their skin or the ancestry of their grandfathers. And it doesn't seem so odd in the classical music field, and I don't want to dwell only on that, but when we get into literature, and we get into some other things, people who say, well, only a black person can teach Negro literature, I wonder, well, why can't I read Langston Hughes, and if I were a specialist in literature, teach Langston Hughes's literature? Why can't I do that? If I can't, can not a black person write intelligently, as so many have, on Hemingway? I think of Shelby Steele, a man who is a superb scholar, and I wonder, will it come to a point, Dr. Reisman, in which no one will allow anyone to be authoritative except in that which is in his blood, to use the cliche? If it isn't in your genes, you can't talk about it, because obviously how could you absorb it, and how dare you desert your own ancestry to look at something outside your own ancestry?
Well, there are quite a few points you're making, and I don't know that I can answer them all. But I would say that what's being omitted in this equation when people are saying you have to be black to appreciate black literature, or you have to be Austrian to like Mozart or whatever, the one thing that's being dropped out, which is something universal to all human beings, which is that they possess the faculty of reason. Now, all of us possess reason, and if we attach value to reason, then what we have in common far outweighs what separates us. The fact that you may have been brought up perhaps to like sauerkraut and someone else likes rice, that's a trivial difference. It's much more in common that you both possess reason, and what civilization centers on is reason and its leading intellectual products. Yes. And if we look at that, then we have something that all of us can share, and which is the most important thing. Reason is the foundation for science, for all of the arts. This is what unites human beings. Now, in the case of something like music, I don't think we could make a convincing case that Mozart is better than Bach or Beethoven or whichever. It's a matter, I think, largely of personal preference.
I might try to make it, but I agree there are those who would disagree on that. But
and I happen to share your preference for Mozart, by the way.
We might, I think, be able to make a plausible case that Mozart is better than Madonna. Might
we? I would agree with
and
that.
And that Mozart is better than Two Live Crew, and that Mozart is better than heavy metal.
Right.
And we would be doing it. Grant, aesthetics is a very tricky field.
Right.
But there are objective criteria that can be applied to culture as well as to scientific and mathematical equations.
Right.
But even without the sort of making this is better than that in some sort of just simply declarative ex cathedra
right.
way, there is certainly a context and a tradition.
Right, and I think that if we deal with the subject of knowledge, if we want to talk about knowledge and take knowledge as our standard, and what is it that achieves knowledge, then we have a fairly solid objective basis on which to make distinctions. I think if one values knowledge, then a radical difference exists between a culture which possesses the art of writing and one which doesn't.
Yes.
Knowledge can only be accumulated on any scale and transmitted if a culture possesses writing. So I'd say the presence or absence of writing represents a major distinction on the basis of which normally we would distinguish between civilization and savagery.
Yes.
Then I would say if one values knowledge, the same thing which makes one value writing over not possessing writing leads one to have to value a culture which understands the laws of logic and the principle of causality. Such a culture occupies a higher place than one which does not possess knowledge of logic and causality, because if you possess those principles, you have the foundation for acquiring further knowledge. We can't acquire knowledge if we don't understand the laws of logic or the principle of causality. It's then an extremely slow process that doesn't get anywhere. So I would say a culture that possesses knowledge of logic and causality is objectively superior by the standard of what serves in the acquisition of knowledge than one which does not possess those things.
Yes.
And on that basis, I would say that Greco-Roman civilization was superior to anything prior to it.
Let me take a break for a moment,
sure.
If we might, and we'll continue with our guest. Dr. Reisman, in your piece, Education and the Racist Road to Barbarism, you make the point, many points, correctly. One, I think that is especially pertinent, which is that Western civilization is by no means exclusively the creation of people who lived in the West of Europe or who got all their ideas somehow from the soil of France. And maybe a few examples of how what we call Western civilization is in fact the confluence of strands of thought and learning from many parts of our world.
Well, that's certainly true. Obviously, there were things handed down from Babylon and ancient Egypt, and in the Middle Ages, while Europe was in darkness, the Middle East was a more advanced culture than the West, and we started modern Western civilization with knowledge acquired from the Middle East. But more importantly than that, I would say there's no more connection between Western civilization in any specific racial or ethnic ancestry than there is between someone liking French fried potatoes and being born in France,
yes,
or liking a New York steak and being born in New York. That's strictly superficial. Western civilization is something that is open to everybody. What it is, essentially, is simply the highest development of knowledge that has thus far taken place. Non-Westerners have contributed. Non-Westerners can absorb it all, and today's Westerners could lose it. It's perfectly possible, if trends continue for the next 100 years the way they've gone for the last 30 or 40, that 100 years from now, Western civilization may reside in the Far East, and much more so than in the West.
A few years ago, Isaac Stern concertized at some length in mainland China. A movie was made of it called Isaac Stern in China. And we saw the development there in among thousands of young Chinese students of a real facility with the violin and, of course, with other, quote, Western instruments. I think of Santo Domingo, which I visited frequently, whence an enormous number of baseball players are coming. Baseball is not a creation of the island of Hispaniola, and yet Santo Domingans are overrepresented among baseball players in the United States, owing to whatever it is. They want to play baseball, they play it tremendously well. It's a minor example of an absorption, should we say, of a Western skill, but it's one of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of examples, both in human beings and in specific isolated instances of people from elsewhere becoming quite adept and becoming really the transmitters of Western culture on the highest level and on levels like baseball. You point out, I think rather forebodingly, but not unappropriately, that we may well find in the next century that the major repository of Western culture is in fact the Far East. It may be the rim, as they call it now. You know, Korea, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and so on may be the places where that stress on learning, on causality, on going from A to B with sense and sobriety is in fact dominant, and we may have descended back into a kind of latter-day barbarism. I hope not, and I don't think it's inevitable by any means, but we certainly don't have any reason to assume that just because one's ancestry is from there and one's skin color is pale as opposed to something else, that therefore one will be a transmitter of Western culture.
I would say a much larger scale example of what you're getting at with your example of Santo Domingo and baseball would be Japan.
Yes.
Japan has absorbed not simply baseball, but all of Western logic, mathematics, science, technology, the capitalist economic system. And in those very essential areas, you know, someone has said at one time, American capitalism is alive and well in Japan. And that's true.
Yes.
Japan, in that sense, may now be a more Western country than the United States currently is.
We've often talked about Western respect for law and for, should we say, the rights of the individual. A young man who had been a listener to my program for some time and has written me periodically wrote a letter to me today from Japan, where he has gone to teach English, and he said what an enormous pleasure it is for him to be able to walk at any time of day or night in any part of the big cities in Japan safely.
Right.
In other words, one of the hallmarks of civilization has been, in general, the safety of the citizens in a rule of law and order, society that respects the innocent and punishes
right.
the guilty. In this country, I can't imagine any American
right.
except perhaps Arnold Schwarzenegger being able to say with a straight face that he could walk in any part of any one of our cities and feel safe from one end of the
right.
of the walk to the next.
A major point that I think it's really important to make, though, you know, in today's universities, the teaching is that all civilizations and cultures are absolutely equal.
Yes.
It's strictly a matter of personal preference, and it's altogether arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is objectively wrong, and I think any university that teaches that is contradicting its own basis of existence. If a university exists, its purpose is to transmit and accumulate knowledge. Otherwise, there's no reason to have it. Now, if any university that exists must implicitly value knowledge, and in the name of the valuation of knowledge, It follows objectively that what we call Western civilization is the highest form of civilization that has thus far existed, on the grounds that it offers the means for the greater acquisition of knowledge. I made the point a little earlier that with writing, you can acquire knowledge vastly on a vastly greater scale than without it. With logic and causality on a still greater scale. Modern Western civilization has a much higher and more extensively developed knowledge of the laws of mathematics and all branches of science than did Greco-Roman civilization. And we have also possessed the freedoms of speech and press and a division of labor economy, which are further major factors contributing to the accumulation of knowledge. For example, in a division of labor, geniuses can specialize in science and invention. And with freedom of speech, no pressure group can stop the dissemination of knowledge by combining superstitious fear and the power of the state. Mm. So these are major requirements for accumulating and transmitting knowledge. And if the universities held the accumulation and transmission of knowledge as a value, they would be logically obliged to teach the objective value of Western civilization, and at the same time that it is open to everybody, black, white, or yellow, and to people of all nations. Western civilization should be the civilization embraced by the whole world. It's universalizable in the name of evaluation of knowledge and human life.
It's really, I suppose, the task of psychologists to look into what motivates people who are themselves well educated in Western civilization to sort of turn their back on it and come up with these, I think, pandering notions that merely suck up to the most, should we say, retrograde elements, and not stand for that which they must from their learning know is worthy, is accessible to all, and is in fact the most liberating of cultures for everybody, that which has made possible the greatest extension of wealth, of health, of all sorts of good things. When you get professors who buy into this, one throws up one's hands in despair, because they are, if they're not the defenders and really the champions of civilization, who is going to be? Surely not demagogic politicians and people who simply live by pandering to the lowest common denominator.
Well, you see, I think if you look at what actually has been going on in the universities for several generations now, today's universities, particularly in the area of the liberal arts, are permeated with a spirit that is hostile to reason and to knowledge. Now, that may sound shocking, and it is in a way, because it's a contradiction of the very purpose for which universities exist. These are like anti-universities that we have, if I can coin a term.
Yes.
But if you look at the ideas that are prevalent on campuses, for example, in philosophy, there are the doctrines of logical positivism and linguistic analysis. Now, logical positivism teaches that we cannot know anything with certainty that is true of the real world. Linguistic analysis teaches that the pursuit of truth is a word game.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a whole set of varieties of collectivism, which teach that a person's ideas are determined by his class membership or his racial membership or his nationality or sex.
Or this new deconstructionist horror that Professor Bloom, I think, will help skewer with us here on Monday night next. This notion that you take literature and everything, you just sort of, in a sense, destroy it through a kind of analysis that takes away its meaning, mm-hmm. and reduces it really to rubble, for political purposes, I think, far more than for scholarly purposes. And I think the politics plays in so closely to this assault on Western culture and this sort of glorification of a kind of, if you will, barbarism, using your own term here in a slightly different context, that in essence, one wants to just sort of pummel them and say, look, can't you get your head straight here, that your political desires are one thing, but your denigration of culture and civilization is a very dangerous thing, irrespective of whether your politics are right or wrong.
Well, you see, a serious problem for these people is that their politics could not stand rational examination. If they claim that they are advancing programs designed to serve human life and well-being, that can be examined objectively, and either the programs will or won't. And it turns out that socialism and everything connected with it is a program aimed at the destruction of human life and well-being, and that's now confirmed by events in Eastern Europe and Russia. But the great majority of intellectuals for quite a long time have been advocates of socialism, and they could only maintain their advocacy by doing something to deny the validity of logic, because they had no logical basis for their position.
Let me break, and then we'll go to calls with our guest. Professor Reisman is our guest. Jeff, good evening. You're on with our guest.
Yes, I have to agree with you that Mozart probably represents the apex of Western music, and I hope that you play the Requiem Mass when you to celebrate his 200th anniversary of his death.
I have every intention of doing so.
That would be simply lovely.
What would you like to say to or ask about
this? I have a classical education, and I think that the attitude of the universities today towards kind of a ethnic chauvinism is really rather reprehensible, but I have to disagree completely that it's possible to objectively analyze one culture as being superior to another on the basis of mastery of cause and effect or scientific effort. I mean, you have to remember that Western culture also produced Hitler and the atomic bomb. And I really can't see that there's some sort of cultural superiority based upon
Western culture did not Western culture did not produce Hitler. Hitler was born in a Western country, but everything that Hitler believed intellectually was contrary to the essentials of Western culture.
Oh, I disagree completely.
Hitler openly identified himself as an enemy of reason. The foundation of Western culture is reason. Hitler was an advocate of unrestrained force and violence. That's hardly Western culture. He was an advocate of collectivism, not individualism. That's not Western culture.
So I honestly think that the idea that do you really think that Mozart sat down and rationally figured out how to write the Requiem? That's
no, he certainly didn't.
That's completely absurd.
Excuse me.
Beautiful in Western culture.
Pardon me?
Gentlemen, we can't both talk at the same time. We have some slight echo here, so let's talk one at a time. Dr. Reisman, please.
All right. A musician does not figure out how rationally to compose each note. His subconscious takes that over for him. Similarly with any writer, your subconscious does a lot. But anything that gets into your subconscious first had to go through your conscious. And the essential of Western civilization, the criterion by which I said it's objectively superior, is the means of acquiring knowledge. Please hold that in mind. If one values knowledge and asks what are the requirements for achieving knowledge, then the laws of logic are absolutely essential. The understanding of causality is essential. The development of all of the principles of science is essential. Freedom of speech is essential. The division of labor economy is essential. Modern Western culture has all of this. It has more of the requirements for achieving knowledge than any previous culture. So if a university did value knowledge, which today's universities apparently do not, but if they did, in the name of that value, they would have to value Western culture.
Jeff?
Well, there are examples of cultures that are not involved at all with rationalities that reach their own peaks, that reach their own superiorities. Let me give you a couple examples.
But not of knowledge.
A major threat.
Not of knowledge.
Hang on. Let me finish. A major threat of Chinese culture, for example, is Taoism, which is a trans-rational or non-rational philosophy. It does not acquire or think about life in terms of cause and effect. Now, whether knowledge represents somehow some objective goodness or the accumulation of facts or of information, many people would argue that a culture that could produce a Hitler, regardless of whether you want to kind of take the good in Western culture and put the bad, put the Nietzsches and the Hitlers and the atomic bombs aside, just look at the good and you look at the good and just kind of ignore the bad. I cannot imagine, for example, the Chinese Taoist threat in Chinese culture producing that kind of situation.
It produced Mao Zedong, who killed more people than Hitler.
Let me give you another example.
Ignoring that one.
Let me give you another example. There's natives in New Guinea whose total mathematical knowledge consists of a number system that goes one, two, many.
Yeah.
That's their total mathematical system.
Yeah.
And you know, they spend a lot of time talking about what they dream about. And in fact, there's kind of like no separation between their waking life and their dreaming life.
I think
psychologists have talked to these people. And
yes, but you see, you're omitting the value of knowledge. You're a university graduate, and you attach no significance to knowledge.
There's no incidence of psychosis. There's no incidence of neurosis.
They can't distinguish consciousness from a dream.
Psychologists, as they look at these people, say that these are the most psychologically healthy people in terms of not having crime, not having certain other aspects of Western civilization, which you just...
Psychologists who would say that, I would say, disqualify themselves as psychologists.
Jeff, I think we got the point. Let's move on and take one final call with our guest. Roger, good evening.
Good evening, David.
Hi, Roger.
I'm not sure whether I'm on track with what this conversation's about, but I'll try anyways. I'm a black student, and I took a history class in high school about 3 years ago. I was in the 11th grade. And basically, I was taught that black people were slaves, and then Abraham Lincoln freed us, and then Martin Luther King helped that process along around the 1960s. And with very few exceptions, I think this is more the norm than some weird tangent all over the country. And I'd just like to ask your guest a question. Why should black students be forced or expected to exalt white Western culture over their own when many whites can't even recognize the role that we have played in this society enough to put us in the history books?
Well, no one is asking or should be asking anyone to extol white culture or to denigrate people as being blacks or anything of the kind. What one is asked to value rationally is logic, science, mathematics, a free economic system, the right of the individual to pursue his own happiness. That's what one is being asked to value.
Well, yeah, I know, but the point isn't about black people or African-American students wanting to put emphasis upon some mud culture in Zimbabwe. It's about the omission of black Western scholars and intellectuals in literary and history classes in this country.
Any black scholars or contributors who've been omitted should certainly be included, not because they're blacks, but because they're individuals who've made important contributions.
But see, we're led to believe that it's because we're black, because of the history of this country, and we see their omission, and it's 1990, we begin to think, well, maybe things aren't moving along as quickly as we thought they
were. Well, you seem to be postulating some kind of conspiracy theory. I don't agree with that, but there could well be individuals who've been ignored who should not be ignored. There are individual whites who are ignored who should not be. One very leading example of a white woman who's ignored in the universities who deserves enormous credit is Ayn Rand. A leading example of a white Jewish Austrian who's ignored is Ludwig von Mises.
Well, again, you can pick out isolated incidents, but what I'm talking about is a general trend in which black people are either viewed as entertainers. We dance and we sing a lot and we run footballs down the field and we play basketball, but we're not respected as intellectuals.
Roger, let me interrupt because I've talked before. We have only a moment left here. Look, it is obviously the case that much of our education system, and you've given examples of that phenomenon, are in fact inadequate in that they have tended not to stress what endures in a culture and instead have isolated it into what the person looks like who may have done a particular event. What Dr. Reisman is trying to point out is that whatever your race, religion, background, etc., that there are cultural ingredients that conduce, should we say, to civilization and those that don't. If an angered black student says, well, because the history books haven't dealt adequately with us, I will turn my back on Shakespeare, on Mozart, on Goethe, and what I will do is I will learn tom-tom beatings from what might have been my tribe 150 or 300 years ago in Africa, and from that I will glorify my ancestral roots. What is the purpose of it for him? In what way does he educate himself?
I don't see the instance where they're attempting to turn their back on Western culture and glorify tom-tom.
But they are.
What I see is a rejection of the notion that white supremacist ideology should be regurgitated in order to get good grades.
We don't have enough time to go forward. Roger, call me again. I want to talk more with you about this.
Okay.
Thank you, Roger. Dr. Reisman, thank you very much for being with us. As you can see, it's something we should spend at least five days on, not one hour, but it's a start, and I hope people will get the article and read it and think about it.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to have you with us tonight,
sir.
And good night. Bye-bye. This is WBZ AM 1030. We'll be talking with...